Welcome. It's so nice to be here. I was just reading through the chat and where you're all coming in from, and it's so lovely to see so many different nationalities here from Estonia and Dublin and Italy and the US and many, many other countries, England and my homeland and beyond. So, welcome. As Mani mentioned, and as the write-up mentioned, I'm going to be speaking about the place of nature awareness in our practice, and also how we can draw on the wisdom and the goodness of the natural world, both in our meditation but in our life. And so, because of that. I'm going to suggest, if you can, if depending on your time zone and whatnot, if it is still daylight and you can orient to something in nature, which might be looking out a window, or some way that you can reference the natural world would be ideal. Just like, or you can look at this beautiful oak tree that's behind me, this California live oak. I see a few of you sitting outside. Just helps to draw on that very sort of lived experience, since I'm pointing to that. So just a couple of words before we meditate together. I'm just curious, actually. Let me see. Can I do? I think I can do a gallery view here. Yeah. So a couple of things. One, if you have a chance to turn your video on, even just for a moment, so we can say hi to each other. I think it's a nice thing in community to, maybe you recognize people's names, but it's just nice to see people's faces. And it's like, oh, there's so and so from this retreat or from that online course, or maybe some of you are, I don't know, in bed or got your pajamas on or who knows. Yeah, it's just nice to say hello, in these times of where we spend so much of our time online. It's nice to actually see people's faces, even for a moment, that we know there's actually a human being behind those screens and behind those names. So, yeah, hi everyone. Nice to see you all. And I just noticed for myself, when I see people's faces rather than the black square box with a name or initials, I'm like, oh, right, people, my tribe, humans, fellow humans, all trying to live our lives, trying to wake up together. So thank you for turning on your screens even for a moment. And feel free, of course, if it's not comfortable or appropriate or you don't have the bandwidth to, then of course, no need, no pressure to do that. But just nice to see friends. So I'm going to guide us in a minute in nature meditation practice. And of course, there's many, many ways to do that. And since most of you are inside, I know most of you are calling in from Europe, where it's probably still quite wintry, or tail end of winter, early spring. Where I live in Northern California, it's an early spring. That's because of climate change. It's earlier than normal. But I'm going to draw on, since nature is everywhere and we are nature, then we can always reference the natural world in our practice. And I think it's really important in these times that we learn to do that, both because nature is such a support for presence, awareness. And by doing that, it also connects us to the more than human world, to life beyond ourselves. The problem with our indoor living and screen-oriented living is everything becomes quite a strong mirror back to ourselves, as if life just revolves around us. And when we step outside, we realize, oh, there's a whole universe out there, and I'm just one teeny piece of dust flying through the cosmos for a moment. And so connecting to something bigger than ourselves, the earth below us, the sky above us, the air around us, the life, the human and more than human world around us. It's to contextualize our meditation practice rather than just sitting down and being oriented to our own inner experience, which is fine, But sometimes that can be a little separating to not realize we're always actually in connection. So that's mostly what I want to say. So, and if you are sitting by a window or there's some reference to nature around you, out the door, out window, even a photograph, I have a beautiful orchid on my desk, which I draw on when I look at night when I can't see the natural world outside. Just to take that in for a moment. Just take a moment to reflect, where are you on this earth, right? We are all first and foremost earthlings, right? We inhabit this earth. It's our shared common humanity. We came from the earth. And so sensing into where it is that you live, you know, what place do you live on? What land are you living on? The land, the earth below you, right? What's underneath your house and the neighborhood and the concrete? Yeah. And what's above you? Clouds, sky, moon, stars, space. And what of the more than human world that's around you? Birds, insects, animals underground, right? The creatures living under your house, all the beings we try to keep out of our house, not so successfully sometimes. All right, so with that, you can settle into a meditation posture if you haven't done already. And then feeling into, as you settle and withdraw your attention from the screen, turning the gaze of awareness inwards, feeling this earth body, this body that's expressive of earth element, fleshy, hard, of the earth. The food that you've eaten today is slowly metabolizing, becoming cells, flesh, bone, marrow, blood. So sensing this body as a living expression of the earth, part of the earth's moving surface, feeling its organic nature, feeling its sensory nature. Noticing how we sense organic life through sensation, through touch, through vibration. Sensing how gravity is pulling, holding body, connecting us to the earth's surface, and allowing that gravitational pull to invite a sense of ease, of relaxation, releasing any unnecessary tension. And sensing how you're sitting on the ground, on the earth, even though we're probably on chairs, cushions, floors, buildings, that all those are connected to the earth. Feeling into the earth below you, steady, solid ground. Through the feet, legs, sit bones. Earth sitting on earth, this body of earth aware of itself, and as we orient awareness to feel and sense the body, how do we know body as body? through touch, tingling, vibration, warmth, coolness. We may sense the body as it breathes, body breathing itself, feeling that wave-like motion as breath enters the body through the nostrils, cooler air, perhaps fragrant, entering, inflating the torso, lifting, and then releasing, deflating, moving back through the nose or mouth. And where with each breath, we breathe in oxygen released from the trees and grasses, plants around you. Each exhale, releasing more carbon dioxide, absorbed by forests, oceans. With each breath, we change the atmosphere. With each breath, we connect with all photosynthesizing life, past and present. Connect with all breathing life. And as we attune in this way to the simplicity of organic experience, sensation, breath, time zone, awareness, notices other phenomena, sounds, particularly silence, sounds of nature, human sounds. Noticing how sounds and the soundscape draw us naturally into the present. No need to think about the sounds, simply receiving sounds, silence. In the same way we receive sensations, breath, And of course, other phenomena may arise, emotions moving through the body, felt in the body. Thoughts, images flickering through the mind. All nature, all expressions of nature, just moving through, abiding in awareness, spacious like the sky, receptive, receiving each of these impressions, sounds, sensations, breath, fragrance, mood. And you sense yourself as part of the living surface of the earth, sitting, breathing, aware of itself. In the same way a tree is rooted to the earth. This last part of the meditation, sensing a little more into your elemental nature, the elements that course through all living things, course through our own body. This earth element, this body of earth, flesh, bones, skin, comes from the earth. Eat and digest the earth element. And that earth element is food, becomes muscle, bones. Earth inside, earth outside, same element. In the same way as we breathe, breathing the earth element, the air element, the wind element, the wind that breathes, the air outside, moving through our bodies, our lungs, our veins. Sensing how intimately connected and interdependent we are with breath, with air, with atmosphere. Likewise, the waters of the world and the clouds, and rain, snow, and the oceans and lakes, not separate from the fluidity we can feel in our own body, the moisture in our skin, the saltiness of our tears reflecting the saltiness of oceans, moisture in our mouth, GI tract, blood coursing through our body, same way the water element courses through the land, the streams. Water element inside, water element outside, same element, not separate. Lastly, the fire element, the sun, millions of miles away in space, can be felt as intimately as the warmth in your belly, coolness on your skin. We come into this life a warm-blooded mammal. And we maintain that heat through eating plants that have metabolized the sun's energy. So our body is a living, breathing, walking fire element. Sensing that warmth in your body, in your belly. And all of this is held in space, the earth floating in space. You're an experience held in the space of awareness. And so as we draw this practice to a close, we're just taking a moment as we've sort of reviewed the elements, the elemental nature of experience, how we're intimately supported by these elements. What arises in the heart in response? How can we touch into the quality of gratitude? Since each of these elements keep us alive, and sensing into what of the earth and the waters and the sun and the air and the space? What gratitude comes? And call to mind something particular. And maybe gratitude for the wind, or the beauty of rain, snowfall. All the solidity and the groundedness of earth that we can draw on for resilience. All the joy and the delight that comes from looking at stars at night, spring flowers, sound of a songbird. I'll close with a poem from Rosemary Wetola Trauma called Like the Peony. Like the peony that opens and opens and opens. Peony is a flower, in case you're wondering what the peony is. Like the peony that opens and opens. This is how I want to meet life. Surviving the cold, then returning to bloom again and again. That vibrant, that many-petaled, embarrassingly fulsome, as if life can't just get enough of itself. I know how winter ravages. Sounds like a metaphor, yet truth is life cuts you to the ground and you lose all but the roots, and sometimes lose those too. How is it then comes the chance to bloom again, to be less master of life and more servant to the life that's pushing through. I want to be fluent in blooming. I want to be fluent in blooming. I want to trust the possibility of sweet spring perfume as much as I trust the inevitability of frost. I am so grateful for beauty, albeit brief, for the chance to be naked, tender and soft. And so with that poem, in your own time, feel free to bring your meditation to a close, or if you're enjoying being in that meditative space, then of course you can keep meditating, or you can do what I'm doing and take in some rainwater. This would be rainwater, although sometimes this would be snowmelt from the snow in the Sierra Mountains, about 4 hours north of where I live, which is where we get some of our water. And some of this is just simple, good old-fashioned rain. So the name of the poem, which maybe Marnie can type in, is called Like the Peony. And the name of the poet is Rosemary Wetola Trauma. And you might have to look that up, Marnie, because that's a complicated last name. So, before we, or as I'm talking, if you feel like it, just if anything came to you in that sitting in terms of both orienting to the nature around you, to orienting to the nature within you, and to also orienting to the elements, which for many of you is probably a very familiar practice. And how is it to feel and sense those elements within you as you practice? And so we're sort of widening the field of experience. So it's not just me and my neurosis or whatever we're meditating with. But no, it's the earth meditating through me, you know. It's the forest breathing through me. It's the sun being felt through me. It's the water swishing around in my veins. I'm rainwater, you know, giving the Dharma talk. You know, it's a very different frame of reference to go, oh, right. there's me and whatever your name is and whatever story you have about yourself. Actually, that who I am, as the American poet Walt Whitman so beautifully wrote, he said, "And as to me, I contain multitudes. And as to me, I contain multitudes. I contain the universe." And the Buddha said, everything we can need to learn can be learned in this fathom-long body. No need to go to the edge of the universe, because it's all can be experienced here. Where do we feel the sun that's 93 million miles away? We feel it on the warmth of our skin. So, yeah. So thanks for sharing. Those of you, feel free to share a little more about what you're experienced in the meditation. I can sometimes circle back to some things that Michelle wrote, an overwhelming feeling of being very small. Yes, we are very small. In our mind, sometimes me and my life and my story, my drama feels very big. And that's why, you know, my main teaching, after I give any teaching, and I'll say it now, I usually say at the end, to anybody, anywhere, is go outside, go outside, go outside. Because as soon as we step outside, even if you live in a city, we go outside and we come into, oh, there's a whole world going on there outside of my computer screen and my apartment that has nothing to, you know, with nothing to do with me, really. You know, clouds are blowing by, people are driving along the street, and the blossoms are blossoming, and the birds are migrating, and the moon is waxing, and on and on. And sometimes I can feel like, oh, I'm just a little small middle of me. What is this? I'm not important, and I don't matter. Or we can go, wow, I'm part of everything. You know, that beautiful line from the Sagadhatu said, wisdom tells me I'm nothing, empty, you know. Love tells me I'm everything. And between the two, my life flows, right? And so sometimes we can feel that empty and just there's nobody here. It's just life phenomena happening by itself. And sometimes love, we can feel intimately connected with the stars in the sky, with the blossoms I'm looking down on my street, with the birds that I can hear in the background. So, yeah. So nature practice and nature as refuge, nature as teacher. You know, I think if I was, you know, as I do now, you know, I talk about the four refuges. We have refuge in Buddha, refuge in Dharma, refuge in Sangha, and I add refuge in nature, because without nature, none of that is possible. And nature, for many of us, is a profound source of refuge for all kinds of reasons, for beauty, for nourishment, for joy, for feeling peace or connected, to feel love, to feel held, to feel a sense of belonging or community. You know, and I know probably many of you, how many people go outside into nature to just to enjoy the natural world, park, garden, something? I'm sure most of you, beach, lake, right? So, you know, and it's interesting to think, well, why do I go outside? Why do I go to the park? Why do I go into my garden? Why do I go to the beach or the mountains or the forest, right? What is it that I'm seeking, right? And am I seeking refuge? Is it a refuge? And if so, what kind of refuge is it? And is it a refuge from what, right? You know, we live, you know, these are stressful times. I think it's always stressful times. If you look at, yeah, there's always a lot of drama and suffering going on in the world. Sometimes it feels like more than others, and this feels like a very politically difficult time in the US, but also in Europe and elsewhere, politically, socially, economically. And And so sometimes we go for refuge from that, right? Or we go for refuge from these things, right? Our phones. We go for refuge from being embroiled in technology and we feel like our brain's just about to get fried, you know? Or we take refuge from busyness, or we take refuge from people. Because much as we might like people and love people, sometimes we just want to get away from people. And I know when I go into nature, I go alone. I often think, oh, I should invite a friend. It's like, no, I can go hang out with my friend in a cafe. When I go to the woods, I want to be with the woods. I want to be intimate with the land and the landscape and the birds and the trees and the rocks and the sky. So sometimes we go for refuge to, and sometimes we go to refuge from, right? So sometimes we're going to nature as refuge from all the stuff that's causing us stress, politics, work, family, health, whatever. And then sometimes we go for refuge to, because something we can receive, you know, we go for refuge to the three jewels, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and there's so much we receive from that. So what is it you go for refuge to in nature? Right? Now, I'm happy to say that there's more research coming out, as if we need the research, but we do in our scientific culture, that going into nature is good for us. Surprise! It's good for your heart. Right? Heart rate lowers. Heart rate variability goes up. Cortisol levels go down. Stress levels go down. Levels of well-being, happiness, connection elevate. Basically, we feel good. I could have told the researchers that they didn't need to spend millions of dollars researching that, but you know, research has its place. I just researched I have a course called Mindfulness-Based Nature Connection course. It's a 6-week course that I'm training teachers to teach. And it's as the course says, it's a nature course, and I researched it and same things. Anxiety, depression levels went down. Nature connection goes up. But the question is, why is that? What is it about going outside? You know, when we go outdoors into a garden or park, a forest, a woodland, a meadow, right? We're going outside into a landscape that our biology, our nervous system, our brain knows. Why does it know it? Because we've evolved in nature. We evolved our senses. One of the reasons we see color is because the need for us to identify berries and the colors of berries as to signals of what was edible and what was poisonous. Like our senses co-evolved with the natural world. And so when we go outside, and they've done an interesting study contrasting going for a walk in nature versus going for a walk in the city, going for a walk is more restorative in nature is more restorative because the stimulation is more restful. And there's a beautiful phrase by some researchers. I think it's the Kaplans. They talk about being in nature as attention restoration theory. Attention restoration. That when we go outside into the garden, into the woods, it's restorative for our nervous system. Because our nervous system knows forest. It might not know the particular forest you're going into, but it recognizing, oh, this is home, this is familiar. And what I like to add to that is this is kin. This is kinship. This is family. Like in the Native American tradition, they'll talk about, tree people, animal people, and stone people, and bird people as kin, right? As family. And so there's something very powerful about that. And the other thing that this dovetails with mindfulness practice, some researchers, actually, I think the Kaplan's coined this particular term I'm going to mention. They said that when you go outside for any period of time, the quality of attention that naturally arises is called soft fascination. Soft fascination. Isn't that a beautiful term? Like, rather than let's be mindful together, let's be mindful of our breaths. No, let's be softly fascinated with our bodies. Let's be softly fascinated with how bodies breathe. Let's be softly fascinated with how I feel the breeze on my skin, or I smell a fragrance as I open the window, right? How would that be if you framed your entire practice as an engagement with soft fascination? I'm be softly fascinated with my mind and the way that it imagines and visions and tells stories and creates movies, and right? But when we go outside, that becomes quite obvious, right? That the natural world is so profoundly diverse and complex and dynamic and changing, and often in our experience, beautiful. And so we become naturally allured, naturally drawn into the present, naturally awe-inspired, naturally fascinated. And so I joke about I mostly teach nature meditation practice. I teach nature daylongs. I just taught one yesterday. I teach nature retreats. I run nature teacher trainings. And I joke with people that, you know, especially so often the places I'm in are very beautiful. And I joke, why wouldn't you want to be mindful, you know, when you're walking past a tree that's in blossom, or you're watching snowflakes fall, or you're looking at the night stars, or you're listening to the sound of a songbird? Why wouldn't you want to pay attention? Well, you do. You're naturally drawn. You're naturally allured. And that allurement brings us into the present, brings us out of our self-preoccupation and rumination, connects us with something beyond ourselves, often connects us to something beautiful, not always, but often. And so what happens to the heart? We start to feel with that, from that self-fascination, we start to feel a little expansive, a little delight maybe, joy, curiosity, wonder, beauty. I was teaching yesterday in some hills along the coast near where I live. I live in Northern California, just north of San Francisco. And my sister happened to be in town from England, and it was fun to see the place through her eyes, and how I wouldn't say she was softly fascinated. I'd say she was wildly fascinated by, you know, you're at a different place, and there's just different flowers and different grasses and different birds, and that day of practice becomes quite effortless and seamless to be present. So often I hear from, you know, people, there's a cat outside my window. His name is Chesterfield, and he is a marvel of nature, and he would like to come in, but there actually is another window that's open. He just likes to get my attention. I started seeing these notes about the cats, like, cats are wondrous. And I'm like, why are they talking about cats? I'm like, oh yeah, I know what's happening. Everyone's becoming softly fascinated with Chesterfield. So when we go outside, that the soft fascination, that allurement, takes us, you know, out of ourselves, as it were, out of our stories, dramas, stress, into the present, into our bodies, into our senses. And in those moments, and they can be a moment, they can be many moments, they can be minutes, hours, when we go outside, to the beach, to the park, they can be profoundly restorative. And restoration, attention restoration theory. They can be profoundly restorative, nourishing, regenerative, And given the times that we're living in, where most people are recording quite high levels of stress, of anxiety, of depression, and maybe it's not depression, but just, you know, angst or stress. Anybody here stressed a little bit? Anybody? Just a mild bit of anxiety or concern or worry? Yeah, people smiling when I say that, because like, yeah, of course, right? Life is, you know, challenging, all kinds of different levels. Even if you have a very blessed life, there are challenges. You have a body, you have family who may be getting sick, you have things that are out of your control, like the political system. So we come into nature, and whether it's for a minute or an hour or a day, or we look out the window even, maybe it's too cold to go outside, but you look outside and you're looking at rain, you know, coming down sideways, which I love to watch. Or right now I'm watching a squirrel on the, you know, the telegraph pole outside my house. And it, like, in that moment of looking at the squirrel, like nothing else exists. Like I'm just with squirrel consciousness. And it's like fun, it's playful, it's inquisitive, it's big fluffy tail. And I'm kind of in love, I'm in awe, I'm kind of curiosity. And it's and I can feel it's like a balm, like soothing to the soul, soothing to the heart, right? In that moment, I'm not anxious. In that moment, I'm not worried about my back pain or about the political circus. I'm not, you know, I'm just here. Yeah. And so these moments are really essential. You know, that line from the Buddha that I love a lot, and the line that really struck me when I first started practicing. I learned to practice meditation and discovered Buddhist teaching in the East End of London in Bethnal Green a long time ago. And the line was, whatever the mind frequently dwells and ponders upon, that becomes the inclination of the mind and heart. So if we incline towards the news, if we incline our intention to the news a lot, which many of us do, because it's kind of hard not to look at the news, then what happens? That becomes the inclination of the heart. And what happens when we watch the news? We feel probably anxious or activated or stressed or worried or who knows? And it's important to know what's happening in the world. But what if I also incline my mind to the fact that the cherry trees in my neighbor's garden are blossoming? Yeah. And the clouds, the cumulus clouds, are blowing in from across the sky. And I open the window and I can smell the air is scented because the jasmine flowers have started blooming in my neighborhood, and it feels spicy. It smells spicy. Right? And so, this, I think, is a very simple way to take care of our mind and heart and our well-being. And it's very simple and it's very easy. And best of all, it's free. It's free. It requires no Netflix subscription. It requires no membership to a club. You just look out the window, or you go into your garden, or you go down to the park, or you walk around your neighborhood, or you look up at the sky, or you open the window and listen to the sound of a bird or the sound of wind or the sound of rain. And it is restorative. This is a poem. It's called, and maybe Marnie can type in the name of this, Remedy for Social Overexposure by Sandra Cisneros. I believe a Mexican author. And I'm going to paraphrase it a little bit and shorten it. Seek out a tree and sit beneath immediately. Remove from ears and tongue all words. Fast from the same. Soak in a tub of seclusion. Rinse face with wind. In extreme cases, douse oneself with sky, then swab gently with clouds. Place moonlight in a bowl, sleep beside and dream of flowers. So I love this idea of, you know, going out to the trees, soaking in seclusion, rinse your face with the wind, douse oneself with sky, and then see what that does to the nervous system. This is another way of putting it. This is from the writer, poet, John O'Donohue, such a beautiful nature lover and mystic. And he said, and this is really pointing to it's a very, very long poem. I'm not going to read. I'm just going to read a slice of it. And I don't know the name of it. But Marnie, if you catch a line, you might be able to pull up the name of the whole thing. He says, you have traveled too fast over false ground. Now your soul has come to take you back. Take refuge in your senses. Open up to the small miracles you rush through. Open up to the small miracles you rush through. Become inclined to watch the way of rain when it falls slow and free. Imitate the habit of twilight, taking time to open to the well of color that fostered the brightness of day. It's my favorite line here. He says, draw alongside the silence of stone until its calmness can claim you. Draw alongside the silence of stone until its calmness can claim you. Or draw alongside the silence of an old tree until its calmness can claim you. Or draw alongside the stillness of a pond until its stillness can claim you. Or draw alongside a beautiful blue sky until its vastness can claim you, right? Or draw inside, let's see if I can do this sound. You see this? Draw alongside, this is a houseplant, this is a Phalaenopsis orchid. Draw alongside the beauty of an orchid until its beauty can enliven you. So, you know, what I'm pointing to is very simple, and people might think, well, it's a little bit simple, like, you know, life isn't all, you know, clouds and roses, you know, a lot of suffering out there. And it's true, there's plenty of suffering out there, and there always will be suffering out there and in here. And we live on this earth, and we live with our senses, and we live with the ability to have agency over what we do with our attention. And does our attention, as it's negatively hardwired to do, which is to bias towards the negative, or can we also incline the attention to beauty, to goodness, to light that we might like in the sky, to what's emerging out of a cold winter, which might be the beginnings of, you know, crocus and daffodils and other early spring flowers. Like, oh, right. Despite the cold, long, dark winter, things are beginning to emerge. The buds on the trees are beginning to grow. Maybe for some of you, the blossoms are starting to open, or the leaves are starting to open. It's like, oh, right. Nature teaches us about resilience, about regeneration, about possibility. This oak tree that is in the back garden, it was a very, very heavy mast year, M-A-S-T, mast year, which means that for some reason, somehow, all the oak trees, in this case, a California live oak tree, they all know to generate a lot of acorns in a particular year. It's true with pecan trees and walnut trees, and that there's a similar kind of fruiting that I don't think is understood yet. Why some years this tree spawned thousands and thousands and thousands of acorns, It was just incredible. It was like, I thought someone was machine gunning the roof. It was just bang, 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 bang for months. And now they're all starting to grow. It's this little forest of baby oak trees. And it just warms my heart to see life regenerative, right? You know, life is regenerative. The earth is regenerative. Despite what humans do to the earth, it still regenerates. It might regenerate with more difficulty in some places, but it regenerates. Spring comes. The new moon comes. And so we can take refuge in cycles, in seasons, in regeneration. With decay comes regeneration. With death comes rebirth. And so to see what it's like to then take this mindful attention, this meditative awareness, and maybe when it gets warmer, you know, more conducive enough for wherever you're living, to take your meditation practice outside, which is what I do mostly, unless it's raining. And then I walk in the forest in the rain because I love the rain. But to see what it's like when you go outside in your garden or in a park, and the sounds are mostly the sounds of wind and birdsong. And the sensations are less your back pain, but more the breeze on your face and the wind blowing your hair. And the sensation of warmth of the sun coming in and out of the clouds. And just see what that does to your sense of connection, presence, embodiment, aliveness, joy. A lot more to be said about that. As you may know, I'm going to be teaching a four-part class starting in April, starting on Earth Day, actually, April 22nd, where I'm going to unpack some of these nature teachings and give a lot more meditation instruction. So you might want to check that out. Marnie, maybe you can post a link to that in the, maybe at the end she'll do that. Where I'll explore a little more about nature practice. And I know many of you are calling in from either the East Coast or from the North or from Europe. And April will be hopefully a nicer time to be meditating outside. So if you join me in that, I'm hoping that you'll be able to do that sitting outdoors and then begin to see some of the fruits of that. So maybe that's enough words for me for now. And I'd love to hear from you, either questions, reflections, anything you'd like me to speak more about. So just for background, I mean, I've been teaching the last 25 years but focusing a lot of most of my teaching now is nature meditation teaching, retreats and whatnot. And so I have a lot of experience in that. So feel free to ask me anything about nature practice, nature meditation, or anything else that you think would be useful. So I'll pass over to Marnie and she'll guide us in how we do the Q&A part. Right. Before I do that, I'll just mention about Dana, because I think that was a request. So a couple things to say about Dana. So as a Buddhist meditation teacher, I've had the good fortune of, you know, being around the Dharma for many decades and received beautiful teachings from my teachers, including Christopher Titmus, who was just teaching for Sangha Live. That's where Martin and I met on a course in Bodh Gaya in India in 1992. And probably like you, and I've sat with many teachers, many retreats, and many traditions, but mostly in the insight Vipassana tradition, and had the good fortune of being with teachers and meeting teachers who've given beautiful teachings, and it's all offered on Dana, all offered out of the generosity of their hearts, out of the love of their practice. And so, you know, I felt tremendous gratitude and indebtedness for those teachers for sharing themselves so fully and freely. And in my teaching ministry the last 25 years, that's mostly how I've taught, is through offering retreats on Dharana. And it's been beautiful to be supported in that. It's a beautiful way that allows these teachings to be very affordable and to allow as much access as possible. So I believe these teachings are offered on Dharana. And of course, these communities like Sangha Live, they very much thrive on the support and the connection and Dharana of people like you. So whether you're sitting with me or Martin or any other teacher, please, if you can, be generous with your support, because this is how it supports these teachers like Christopher, like Martin and myself, to keep offering these teachings. So thank you for any Dharana that you offer. I think Marnie's posted something in the chat. But for now, let's open up for questions.
It's most helpful if you can raise your digital hand. And that can be found in the React tab, just underneath our videos here. And that puts you in a queue, and Mark can see the hands raised, and either he or I can call on you as we have time for. The chat can be very busy. So if you need to reserve the chat for posting, because you can't unmute or you can't come on live, that's fine. I'll monitor that. But it's most helpful if you can relay your inquiry with Mark, either on camera so he can be with you and see you, or by unmuting when we call on you. Yeah.
So over to you. Feel free to raise a hand. You could also write a question in the chat if coming online seems too intimidating. Yeah, what would you like to hear more about or ask about, or any kind of guidance you want about specific practice, or anything you want to ask about what I've said, or anything else? Any reflections on your own nature practice? And if you don't ask questions, I'm just going to have to keep talking. You know, it's like, yeah, it's a bit of a mixed bag. So this is a very quiet group, or shy group, or something. As I say, feel free to put something in the chat if you. I should read the chat, because there's a lot of things that were happening there in the chat I might be able to comment on. But Marita, please.
Hello.
Hi.
I was. It's a story that just came to my mind, was the story about the mustard seeds.
Mm.
You remember the story about the woman,
yep,
who lost a child?
I do. Yep.
It just came to my mind when, you know, sometimes I'm walking in the forest with my dog almost every day. And sometimes I just feel sad because I see how the trees are struggling, and the people in charge in my town, Stockholm, they don't take care about the trees or any of the greenery, really.
Mm-hmm.
And how to deal with the sadness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you for raising that. So there's a phrase, which is really a teaching now, that was a phrase that was coined by a eco-psychologist called, the word he coined was solostalgia. And I'll type it in the chat because it's hard to... solostalgia. And what that word means is that when we go in, it's a combination of place, Greek word, place and pain. And it means that when we go into nature, whether it's you going down the street, seeing a tree that's, you know, suffering, or park or forest, which is true very much in many places now. We go into nature, I see the effect of the drought, the effect of the floods, the effect of the fires.
Exactly.
And instead of feeling the joy that we may have felt in the past, we now feel sadness and grief. And often our experience of being outside in nature is twofold. It's both joyful. I love seeing, like I was teaching last month at Spirit Rock, which is a meditation center here. And it was a beautiful spring day, except it was February and it should be cloudy, rainy, and cold, not warm and sunny and blooming wildflowers, because it's too early. And that's happening everywhere. Right? Spring comes earlier, winter comes later. And that's very, very disruptive for life and plants, and particularly migrating birds and animals. And so this word solastalgia is, for me, it really spoke to what I live with, which is my, you know, I both feeling the love of the earth and my concurrent sadness or grief about what's happening to the planet. And so a practice of mindfulness, of bearing witness, of being present to whatever's here, pleasant and unpleasant, joy and sorrow, is a very powerful practice. So we don't run from the pain. We feel it. You know, we're tender with it. But we, you know, it's an equanimity practice of like, and this too, right? There's beauty and there's struggle. And this tree is lovely and suffering, just like people are beautiful and suffering. And so the invitation is to as much as you can, to be in nature and feeling whatever arises. And sometimes it's beauty and joy, and sometimes it's sadness and grief. And to welcome that as much as anything else. It's an important part of how we are living now.
Yeah. Exactly.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So, yeah. Okay, Mani, next question.
There's a lot in here. Here's one by Elizabeth. It's very difficult going through this life, especially when you go through so much inner turmoil. And oftentimes it appears that no one understands or gets you, or for that matter, even really cares about what you're going through and are experiencing. You feel very much like you are walking in this life alone. I don't know if that's a question.
No, I thought I read it as a statement. Yeah, it's I read it as a, you know, just an expression of my chat box has disappeared, so I can't see it anymore. I read that as a, you know, as a painful expression of the dukkha that this person's living in. Just like I was saying to the last person around, you know, meeting the grief, sadness that we might feel when we're, you know, in nature, could be equally true feeling, you know, the struggle and the sadness of our own life and the tenderness of what's here. And, you know, the appropriate response to any of that kind of pain is suffering. It's compassion, right? Is meeting that with a tender heart. And practice is, you know, it requires a lot of courage to be willing to be open to say yes to all of it. To feel it, to feel the beauty, to feel the joy, to feel the sorrow, to feel the loneliness. And sometimes when we're suffering, it exacerbates the sense of being alone with it and the loneliness with it. And actually think that's a layer that the Buddha spoke to about the second arrow, which is sometimes we feel isolated as if we're the only one. And of course, we're never the only one, because there's an immensity of suffering out there. And sometimes our suffering can actually help us feel into our common humanity, because that's often what connects us more than anything, is our suffering. Yeah. So I invite that person who wrote that to, if however you can, both to be tender with the pain that you're in, but also what is it to reach out, to find connection, including, and I'm happy that you're here, both in connection with community, but also sharing that, because there's something about the naming of it also helps, gives us more capacity to be with it. So, Marty, for some reason, I've lost something happened weird to my Zoom. So I actually can't, I have no access to the chat box anymore. I've got no lower bar. So you're going to have to be my eyes and ears on the chat.
Yeah. There's a lot of commentary. So it's someone else is just saying they feel this way. And when they do, they go out in nature. And I've sat with Mark and you've taught that. It's this art of titration, like to go in and maybe touch that pain with a resource. So I'm hearing you say that going into nature can be, for many of us, that resource where we feel something else for a moment. We touch that awe, that beauty, and then we can come back with skill and touch back into that pain.
Nature, just like practice is a refuge, and community can be a refuge, and awareness is a refuge. Nature is also a refuge, I remember once I was on a 3-month retreat and I was working through a lot of very painful trauma, and it was actually so painful I couldn't sit. I couldn't assume the posture because that was aggravating the trauma. And so I had long weeks of mostly just walking outside in the snow, dealing with a lot of tenderness and grief and pain in my heart. And nature was a great refuge. Doesn't make the pain go away. Pain is pain. And if there's a cause, it's to be, felt and understood and all that. But I felt like the trees were companions. And I felt like that walking in the snow, at times, I could access something other than the pain. I would access connection or curiosity or some aliveness or whatever it was. And so, as I mentioned in the talk, that we forget sometimes that we have agency over what we pay attention to. And the nature of pain draws us into it. And sometimes that's healthy and necessary. And sometimes we need to be more actively, as you were pointing to, reorienting the attention or titrating the attention from the source of pain, stress, grief, distress, to something that's not that. Because we can't just face and look at suffering without any respite, because it's too much. We need to balance, right? Practice is about balance. And so when I went to Joseph Goldstein, who was my teacher during that 3-month retreat, I said, Joseph, I feel like I'm a pathetic yogi. I'm out here walking in the woods, listening to his Sony Walkman, which, by the way, is going to date me. It was a Sony Walkman. And I was listening to his, I think it was cassette tapes of classical music in the woods. And everybody else was, suffering with their knee pain in the Dharma hall. I said, I feel like my practice has fallen apart. I've been meditating for 15 years and it's too painful for me to sit. What's going on? All I can do is walk in the woods and try to ground. And he said, practice is whatever helps you come into balance with what's happening in the moment. Right? So some people, their practice is not sitting with the overwhelming pain, it's walking around the neighborhood or going to the botanical gardens or stroking their cat or talking to a friend and sharing what's going on. That's, if that helps you bring you to balance, that's good practice, right? And so practice always looks different to different people at different times, right? So, but what I'm emphasizing here is to make use of nature, not in a utilitarian way, but to realize how resourcing, nourishing, Being outdoors is expanding the frame of attention. It allows us, just like we use that frame, you know, imagine mind awareness like the sky, when we can feel into that, or when we're actually outside taking in the sky, as I was teaching yesterday, and someone was going through a lot of pain yesterday on my day long, but when they were able to lean into the sky, they had more capacity to feel what was going on. When I was leading a kayaking retreat last November, I did these kayaking retreats in Baja, Mexico. They're week-long silent retreats. And it's kind of rugged, wild wilderness down there. And it was during the election, the U.S. election, and we were off-grid. So we didn't know the election result. I didn't want to know the election result. And I didn't want anybody else knowing the election result, because I knew as soon as they knew, it would completely disrupt the rest of the retreat. And one person, who's a dear friend of mine, couldn't resist swimming out to a boat to talk to this boat of divers to find out what was going on with the election. And she found out, and it was very obvious, because she came back in tears, and everybody else kind of knew, oh my God, the election went that way. Oh my God. And she was extremely, you know, as a queer woman, she was extremely upset by the election result. This was the middle of a silent retreat in the middle of the wilderness. But she said, she, you know, the wilderness, sitting, being in nature by the ocean, like she, it was like a crucible, and that non-distracted, that support that she felt from nature was really helped her to ground and integrate and be with the pain, hold the pain. So, other questions, feel free to raise your hand, or Mani, is there other things in the chat box I should be aware of? Okay, I'll read it. For those people who can't see the text box, I would appreciate any insight and suggestions you may have to offer someone who is finding it so difficult going through this life. I feel like I just want to hide from it because it's so painful to feel this way for such a long time. Part of the problem is that I'm very isolated. My best friend of nearly 20 years was tragically murdered by her partner, going on 4 years next month. Now I feel like I have no one else to fill the void of my friend's loss. Please help. Well, Elizabeth, first, I'm sorry to hear both about the loss and also about the isolation, because it sounds like the isolation and you having to hold the pain is what's particularly or adding to the intensity of the suffering. And whatever I can say here is going to be, you know, inconsequential, really, to both what you're going through and what you need. I would absolutely say that whatever you can do to get help from another person in person would be the best thing that probably could help you. It sounds like you're very alone and isolated in your pain, and that isolation is just adding to the intensity of the pain. So I don't know what your situation is. I don't know where you are. I don't know what your circumstances are, but, you know, I'm glad that you brought it up, because naming it is important. Asking for help is important. But you know, there's a limit to what we can do here online. But I would suggest that you, if you can, if you know resources where you live in your community, in your sangha, mental health support, therapy support. It sounds like you really need somebody else to support you and hold you. It might be a person, might be a group. I don't know if Marnie, if you have anything else to add from a sangha life perspective, if you can maybe reach out to this person after the call with any more resources, but I'm afraid there's not much I can do beyond that, but except to really encourage you to keep reaching out for support, however you can, from friends, from family, or from, you know, professional support, and particularly kind of a therapeutic support. You know, and of course, you know, I'm pointing to nature as a support, as a refuge, but I think when particularly when the much of our pain is relationally induced or caused, in this case, the loss of your friend, amongst other things, that suffering is best met in a relational situation, as in with another human being. You know, it's hard to heal the suffering that comes from relationship alone. It often is healed in relationship, if possible. Yeah. So I'm just wishing you well with whatever it is that you're going through, and I hope you can find support. All right, I'm aware of the time. We have about, we're already at time. What else to say? I'm going to share a couple of words from that same poet I referenced before, because it speaks to both what Elizabeth and also what Marita was pointing to. And I won't share again all the poem, it's too long, but it's a poem called For When People Ask. For When People Ask. And she writes, I want a word that means okay and not okay. More than that, a word that means devastated and stunned with joy. The heart understands swirl, but how understands the churning of opposite feelings, leaves us wordlessly deeper into ourselves and blesses us with paradox. So we might walk more openly into this world so rife with devastation, this world so rife with joy. So this is the world we live in. It's both beautiful and tragic and ecstatic and full of suffering. And our practice is to meet all of it. And my reason for teaching today was to invite us, encourage you to take advantage of the beauty and the nourishment and the restorative nature of nature, and to, as the great naturalist John Muir said, go out into nature and receive its good tidings, its blessings. Thank you everybody for being here with me. It's been sweet to connect. I haven't been on Sangha Live for a while. Mani, if you wouldn't mind just reposting those links. So if you want to find out more about me or what I'm doing, I've got a lot of teaching, both online, in person. And as I say, I mostly lead nature retreats, but I am leading this mindfulness teacher training with Martin in the US this fall. It's a year-long professional training called through the Mindfulness Training Institute, which you can Google. I also teach through my organization, Awake in the Wild, bringing these nature meditation teachings out, and through my nonprofit, Mindful of Nature. Hope to see you either on the upcoming Sangha Live course, which is coming up soon, starting April 22nd, which is Earth Day, 4-week class. Other times, other places here and beyond. So let's, Mani, can you repost those links, please, that you posted? Thanks. Oh, you did. Okay. My website's on there, so you can look at that stuff. All right.
And we'll be posting next week. We'll be posting about your 4-week course. So that'll come super. This week.
And I do Awaken the Wild trainings in Europe every few years. So there'll be one in a couple of years. Okay, buddy. Everybody, thank you so much. Feel free to unmute yourselves and say goodbye.